Welcome to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, broadcasting live from East Vancouver, Canada. I'm your co-host, Joanne Chang, here in the studio with my co-host, Allison Cole.
Hello. I've never heard it referred to as East Vancouver before, Canada.
And in the control room is our talented technician, John Pranger. In the first half of the show, we'll be speaking with Twyla Francois, the head of investigation for CETFA, Canadian for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, and she's also the Central Region Director for Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. In the second half of the show, we'll be speaking with animal rights activist Josh Harper, who has recently been released from federal prison on terrorism charges for advocating for nonviolent direct action. But first, Allison has something to share with everyone.
Yes, did you know that Guardian Month is in May, which starts tomorrow? So you might be wondering, what is Guardian Month? This is a campaign being run by In Defense of Animals, which is a well-known animal rights and animal welfare nonprofit organization in the United States. The basis of the campaign is to initiate a change in language and a change in the common terminology in our everyday English vernacular. IDA's Guardian campaign is the only animal rights project that lets you help animals simply by changing the words that you use to talk about them. This is something you can easily do from the comfort of your couch while talking on the phone or when writing to your newspaper. You can improve the lives of real animals just by choosing the right words and encouraging others to do the same. What IDA wants you to do to start is to replace the word owner with guardian whenever you discuss the animals you share.
I prefer mommy.
Mommy? Sure, that would work too. And so in any situation where you would normally refer to an animal owner, you can use the word guardian or mommy or daddy, I guess, instead. And with this simple change of that one word, you'll now be an activist in IDA's Guardian campaign. They say you should start feeling empowered any minute as soon as you make this change and that your dog will start to wag his or her tail because she understands the difference. Wouldn't you rather have a guardian or a mommy or a daddy than an owner? So this is an easy way that you can make a difference as an individual wherever you are. You might ask how this language change will help animals. A guardian has an entirely different relationship with animals than does an owner. And that relationship works out better for the animals, starting with those who share your home and expanding throughout your community. This simple change reinforces and increases respect, responsibility, and compassion by eliminating the concept that animals are property that we can own and dispose of, and by replacing it with a new idea of their place in society, we actually change their status. This change in status will grant them new rights, and these new rights will gradually force into history at least the worst indignities suffered by our non-human kin. It will be much harder for the law to allow the perpetual confinement of veal crates or the outrageous or outright torture that drives the circus and vivisection industries once society accepts that animals cannot be owned. So your help is needed to promote the Guardian campaign. To do so, everything you need can be found at www.guardiancampaign.org, including ideas to promote language change and educational and marketing materials you can order or download and print. Some ways you can promote this campaign are by emailing your friends and family about it, posting the Guardian website on your Facebook page, or distributing brochures. You can ask your community's animal-related organizations to adopt the language and send a letter to your newspaper. There are also educational lesson plans on the website that you can use to educate kids. Once again, for more information about the Guardian campaign, visit www.guardiancampaign.org and order your free Guardian pack to get started. Guardian Month, May, starts tomorrow.
Great. You know what? I hate the word master. When people say master, it's kind of weird.
But it's an archaic saying. I don't think you're right. It is weird because we're not used to that term anymore. Maybe
right.
That's probably
right.
Why? Probably 50 years ago, it wasn't so weird.
Mom and Dad is what I prefer.
That's cute.
So yeah. On the line is our first guest, Twyla Francois. Twyla is the head of investigation for CETFA, Canadian for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, as well as the Central Region Director for the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. She's here to tell us about some disturbing footage shot in February of this year in two federally regulated horse slaughterhouses in Canada. Welcome back to Animal Voices, Twyla.
Hello.
Hi. So can you tell us what discoveries you made from the footage taken at two randomly selected slaughterhouses in Alberta and in Quebec?
Well, the things we found were completely shocking, but I suppose they shouldn't have been, considering we had done a similar investigation in 2008 at a horse slaughterhouse in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. But I would say what we found with these two plants, one in Alberta, one in Quebec, was actually much worse. They were using a 22 to shoot the horses, but the angle and the trajectory was completely backwards to what was required. So a number of the horses were not being rendered unconscious. They were in just a standard cattle stun box that didn't restrain them at all. So a number of the horses were shot in the right eye, then the left eye, then skimmed over the top.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, one horse suffered for up to 4 minutes. And the other thing that we caught footage of as well was the suspending of live, fully conscious horses by one rear leg. So they're suspended, and the camera angle is looking directly down, and you can see the horse's face looking up. So she's still trying to right herself. Yeah, and one scene, the horse's frantically kicking as she's hung, and the worker comes in to stab her in the jugular, and he's kicked. And this is the other thing, too. You know, what about worker safety?
Right.
Yeah, so it was really horrible stuff, completely chaotic. The stun box is supposed to have one horse. Sometimes there were two, sometimes three shot in front of one another. Just really unbelievable practices that clearly are routine.
So, I mean, it sounds like a lot of things went wrong, but, you know, do you think, what was it that went wrong? Do you think the slaughterhouses were improperly set up for horse slaughter? Was there a lack of personnel training? Like, what exactly is it that allowed this to happen?
I think it's probably a number of those different factors you mentioned. So, we've got the biology of a horse, and they've got these really strong, long necks that are muscular, whipping a small head around, and the effective stun spot in a horse's brain is about the size of a walnut. So if you can imagine trying to accurately hit that. And then the other problem is the fact that they're using a cattle box. There's no way to restrain the horses without breaking their neck. And also, yeah, the lack of training was unbelievable. In that footage, when the worker gets kicked, he's out for the day. The next guy is brought in completely green, and he asks a question, and the worker he's about to replace says, "No, look at the eyes. Always look at the eyes. You can tell they're still alive if you look at the eyes, and here's your knife." Like, that was the extent of his training. And this is the man that's responsible for ensuring every animal is unconscious before it's hoisted. So, it's just all these different factors that produce these horrible circumstances. But one of the plants, Bouverie Exports, is seen as the gold standard of horse slaughter across the world. And so he kills, you know, 200 a day at this plant. They've been open for a very long time. So one would think that it's this well-oiled machine, but it wasn't. It was complete boobery.
Wow. Now, do you think what you found at Bouverie and Richelieu were the two slaughterhouses you investigated? Do you think that was representative of the problems in the entire horse slaughter industry, or were these isolated incidents?
We think that they're representative. The Alberta SPCA, unfortunately, even among industry groups, the Alberta SPCA is known as not being animal friendly. But they tried to claim that this was a one-off, that they're not concerned. But if it's such a one-off, how come those exact same problems were happening at the plant in Quebec as well and in the plant in Saskatchewan? So here we have three of the five in operation that we've had gotten footage at, and all of them show these problems. And because it's inherent, the problems are inherent to the species itself, the horse being a flight animal, and because none of the other operations have any different stun box, we're certain that these are the practices at every single horse slaughter plant.
And so you didn't just pick these two because they had problems. Did you just randomly pick them?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. They were just completely randomly selected.
There's only five in total, right? So
right. There's four now. We did manage to get the one in Saskatchewan closed.
Oh, wow. Good.
Yeah, thank goodness. So we're hoping that's what happens here too. But it's been kind of unbelievable. Mm-hmm. If this same footage was exposed in the U.S., the plants would have been closed, their license would have been suspended, workers would have been charged. Mm-hmm. Here, the FIA is allowing them to continue operating. The only changes that have been made are structural. They've increased the height of the sides of the stun box, and they've added rubber matting. I mean, this is ridiculous. So, yeah, mm-hmm. we're hoping that enough people will go to our website and look at who they're to be contacting, because we need to create some uproar if we expect to get anything done on this.
Now, I read in an interview with CBC, the owner of Bovary Exports, Claude Bovary, said that at any given time, the facility is monitored by six CFIA, which is Canadian Food Inspection Agency, inspectors, and a veterinarian. How can they allow this to happen under their watch?
Yeah, this is the other thing, too, that's really ridiculous. After the Natural Valley Farms expose in Saskatchewan, CFIA did a number of interviews and said, okay, now we know we're stepping up our efforts. But it's a problem within the system itself. They're putting these inspectors and veterinarians into these plants, which are really hostile. When I've gone on investigations and I see problems, I go into the plant and I ask to talk to the CFIA veterinarian or inspector. I always find them in their lab, and when I ask them to come onto the kill floor or come out where the animals are, they don't want to leave their lab because they get bullied. Exactly. It's just this really intimidating environment, and mm-hmm. so this body that's been given the authority to be in enforcement, they've sort of been stripped of that. Anytime they do try to push anything through, they're ostracized, and they've got to go back to that plant again. So, yeah, there were six CFIA vets and inspectors at Bovary. There was at least one at Richelieu, but you don't see them in the footage. They're nowhere near the kill floor, even right. though in 2008, and even still today, they sort of pander to the public, and CFIA senior officials say, yes, every single kill is overseen, but it's clearly not happening.
Right. Now, after reviewing the footage, the CFIA, as well as the Horse Welfare Alliance of Canada, suggested that the footage was fabricated. First of all, who are the Horse Welfare Alliance of Canada, and why would they be more concerned about blaming the video than blaming the slaughterhouses?
Mm-hmm. Horse Welfare Alliance is headed up by a man named Bill DeBar. He is paid exclusively by Claude Bovary, who owns Bovary Exports. And unfortunately, they've added that welfare word in their name, which is really kind of a horrible wording of the word. He's the paid mouthpiece to defend. And they actually started in 2008 after our first investigation.
Now, that's really confusing for the public to have that word, horse welfare in there.
Exactly.
Now, what evidence do you have to prove that the footage was not fabricated?
I guess part of our response to that is, wow, that would be quite an undertaking for us to have pulled off, you know, getting an entire workforce in place and have 200 horses that we could have in our basements being killed. But no, we have had to come up with rebuttals for that. So what we did in the Bovary footage, you hear a screamingly loud radio playing all day, and we were able to hear that it was 107.7 FM out of Lethbridge. So we contacted the program director and asked him for the day's song list from February 19th. He sent it to us, and it completely matches up with the footage. So that's incontrovertible.
That's
and
clever.
Richelieu, yeah. In Richelieu, I actually toured the facility in 2008, so I can say that, yeah, that's exactly their layout. But we have also hired a retired forensic video analyst who used to be with the RCMP, and he's a qualified expert witness and does video authentication. So he's doing that for us right now.
That's great. Now, I understand that the SPCA has also reviewed the footage. What was their conclusion?
Yeah, so the Alberta SPCA, yeah, really ridiculous. They're just poo-pooing it all.
Yeah.
The BC SPCA, who's quite a bit more progressive, them and the Canadian Federation for Humane Societies have written a rather scathing letter and report, and both are calling for the immediate closure of the plant. So this
great.
Is huge, yeah, because unfortunately our little horse group isn't seen as respectable enough or mainstream enough. So it's really fantastic that, that those other groups have jumped on board.
That's wonderful. I hope you'll get them shut down.
Yeah.
Now, are we going to see charges filed against the slaughterhouse owners?
That I don't know. Charges are always discretionary, so it's completely up to the RCMP.
Hmm.
So this is the other thing. Often what's happened in my experience with the RCMP is if we can take it, the issue to an urban detachment, it gets handled seriously. If we take it to a rural detachment, which unfortunately in these cases it has to go to, they know the workers, they know the management, so they're really not keen to prosecute. So that's also why it's so important for the public to express that they're just disgusted about this. Because only if there's enough political pressure will the RCMP really investigate.
Okay. Now, how do we put the pressure on?
So going to the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition website.
Okay.
So it's defendhorsescanada.org. And then we have a list of people to contact there. And very soon we're going to be also putting a call out to contact the Auditor General. Her office is arm's length from government. She can do a review and then report it back to Parliament. So what we're asking is for a performance review of the CFIA. There's just been so many instances exposing all of the problems with the CFIA
mm-hmm.
that we really feel it needs to be looked into. It needs to be restructured.
So will there be charges filed against the CFIA and the vets, or is the RCMP in bed with them as well?
It's a tough one. I mean, with the Natural Valley Farms investigation, after it was done, we had literally hundreds of people from around the world sending us memorial cards for the horses, flowers, candles. And so we went to the rendering pit, which is where all the horse remains, the heads and things were.
Hmm.
And it was just in the middle of the Qu'Appelle Valley, in the middle of nowhere. We were standing outside of the fence, and we suspended all of these, you know, poems and beautiful flowers and everything. We were chased, actually, out of the facility, and security tried to kill us by running us off of a cliff. It was pretty harrowing. It was a high-speed chase at 130 kilometers an hour.
Oh, my God.
So I got home, and I posted it all up on my YouTube site.
Good.
Yeah, but then within a few weeks, the police were on my doorstep. So threatening me with mischief, which is interfering with the use and enjoyment of a space.
Wow.
So I'm not sure who we were interfering with enjoying that horrible
slaughterhouse.
Rendering pit.
Yeah, really.
But yeah, so the experience with the RCMP hasn't been great.
Mm-hmm.
And also with the Natural Valley case, we received a letter from the RCMP sometime after the plant had closed, saying, yes, there were, in fact, welfare violations, but we're not going to pursue it because the facility's been closed. So I don't know. We don't have a huge amount of hope, but we're hoping that they will do the right thing, and if the public scrutiny is high enough, then they'll be forced to.
Great. Now, this next question is, I'm sure, on the top of everybody's minds. I know Allison was asking about this earlier. We're talking about, you know, the improper slaughter of horses, as if horse slaughter is something that Canadian general public is comfortable with if done properly. And I really don't think that that's the case. In fact, I think a lot of people are shocked to find that we're killing horses. Can you tell us why we're slaughtering horses and where the heck are all these horses coming from?
Yeah, and you're completely right. A poll was done that showed that 2/3 of Canadians would like a ban on horse slaughter, and that was before 2008. So that was before these last three exposés. So I'm thinking it's much higher. But what happened was the U.S. Saw the light, and they banned horse slaughter, saying it's too inhumane.
So the entire country did?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's illegal in all of their states. So those horses are now coming up here and going to Mexico.
Right, I've heard that. So why are these horses... Why do they need to die? Where are they coming from?
You know, most of them are pets. It's people that have gotten tired of their pets, and they're hoping to make a dollar off them by bringing them to auction instead of euthanizing them. And the meat is actually going to France, Belgium, and Japan. It's a delicacy. But what's amazing is our footage and footage from a large group in Belgium called Gaia was just released in Belgium last week. The reaction was so unbelievable. It showed really how nasty the meat is from these horses. And the fact is they're pets, so they're getting all of these drugs like phenylbutazone, which is like the aspirin of horses, but it's a known carcinogen. So the Belgian public was so disgusted that all of the grocery stores started pulling the horse meat off of the shelves.
That's great.
It's amazing. So we think that the population in Belgium will realize, you know, that they don't want this. So then it'll be up to convincing France and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Japan has really high standards for their quality of food. So we think that maybe there's hope there, too. But, yeah, so this is the other angle. A group in the U.S. Led by veterinarians did studies looking at all the different pharmaceuticals in the meat, and it's really toxic stuff. It should be illegal to export it, really.
Mm-hmm. I'm quite shocked that people will bring their pets to the auction knowing that they're going to be slaughtered.
I know.
Let's say if you're calling an end to the horse slaughter industry in Canada and the same thing happens in Canada as it did in the U.S., what would happen then? Would all of the unwanted pet horses and retired race horses now go to Mexico to be slaughtered?
Yeah, this is actually, it's a bit of a misnomer. I think well-meaning people have this concern, but if this is passed, and we would have to tie it with a bill that's going through in the U.S. right now that would ban the transport of horses for the purpose of slaughter.
Mm.
So that would, you know, hopefully end them going to Mexico. And also to deal with the numbers that will be remaining, we've got a subsidized euthanasia program, so people can apply to us and we'll help cover the costs of getting your pet euthanized on your farm. There's a number of really good horse rescues that could pick up some of them. But I think the key thing will be that if there's no profit to be made, if there's no more slaughterhouses to take these horses, the breeders will stop breeding.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, groups like the Quarter Horse Association, they have contests, you know, for who can breed the most horses.
Oh,
and
my God.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. And what they're doing is they're rampantly breeding, hoping for that one in a million horse, knowing that all of the other ones can go, they can get $300 per by sending it to the meat man. So I think that if they don't have that income, they mm-hmm. simply won't breed them because the cost-benefit analysis of paying to feed them just doesn't make sense if you're not going to make anything out of them in the end. So I think the problem will actually take care of itself. And really, I mean, nothing is worse than what they're going through at these slaughterhouses.
Right. Oh, wow. That's actually very educational. And, you know, like our other pets, dogs and cats, we don't send them to the slaughterhouse after we're done with them.
And, you know, and that was what completely shocked me because, you know, I do like all species. But I was at the horse slaughterhouse in Quebec and doing just a routine inspection. And I didn't know it was going to be horses. I thought it was a cattle slaughterhouse. But I saw these men and they were shirtless, covered in blood, walking by the pens, and all of a sudden all these incredibly friendly haltered horses came running up to them seeking affection. And you even see that in the killing footage from Richelieu, you know, these really friendly horses continually reaching out to the shooter, and he's pushing them back with the barrel of the gun. It's, you know, it's just such an unbelievable betrayal. How anybody can send an old, you know, a pet to this kind of a fate is just horrible.
Mm-hmm. Can people see the footage on your website?
Yes, yeah. So okay. If they go to defendhorsescanada.org, and then it's Chambers of Carnage is the name of the campaign where they can find all the footage. Unfortunately, YouTube pulled the Bouvry export footage.
Mm.
We think probably Claude Bouvry had contacted
right.
them,
mm-hmm.
But we've managed to put it up on a different site, so it's all still available for viewing.
Great. Thank you so much, Twyla, for being with us again.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. That was Twyla Francois from Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. You can find out more about her campaign and get in contact with her by going to defendhorsescanada.org. You are listening to Vancouver Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, and here's this week's Animal Voices News. The announcement was made. University of Victoria will be going ahead with a mass bunny slaughter on campus while the students are on summer vacation. University spokesman Tom Smith told CTV that a pilot project to catch the rabbits, spay or neuter them, and then release them to wildlife sanctuaries have failed because no one was willing to accept the UVic bunnies. I believe that was a blatant lie, because the real problem here was that the Ministry of Environment would not allow any of the rabbits to be removed from the premise alive because they're considered wildlife. So the only option was to spay, neuter, and return them to UVic. The real issue here is that UVic does not want to see 2,000 rabbits on their premise, even if they're all neutered. And this is why, in my opinion, when they realized that the bunnies couldn't be removed alive, they stopped the non-lethal pilot project short in favor of a mass slaughter. Smith further said that we need to reduce the population to some point to get to a sustainable number of rabbits. However, rabbits have a gestation period of 28 days. There's no such thing as a sustainable population unless you kill them all. But the university isn't interested in killing them all because the rabbits are somewhat of an attraction for UVic. With a partial call, the rabbit population will bounce back fiercer than ever because the remaining bunnies will be compensating for the population loss. The only thing that's sustainable with a call is the exterminator's fat paycheck signed by the University of Victoria. It seems that the university is trying to prolong and worsen the problem rather than finding a solution. They've misled the public to think that it has exhausted all options when in fact it just wants the rabbits gone because they're ripping up the lawn. And that was today's Animal Voices News, brought to you by UVic's cruel and incompetent rabbit population management program.
Well, thank you, Joanne. Interestingly said. I've got your upcoming events. So if you remember, about a month and a half ago, we had Gary Lowenthal from the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale.
Yes.
Remember that? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe our talk with him perhaps inspired some people to actually put on a Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale in Vancouver. So we've got two of them happening this weekend. The first one is tomorrow, Saturday, May 1st, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. It happens at Capers Whole Foods at 1675 Robson Street in downtown Vancouver. That's in the West End. Starts at 11 a.m. and goes to 3 p.m. And for this particular bake sale, all proceeds will be donated to the Rescue Animal Sanctuary on Main Island. Joanne and I have both been there. We know that place well. It's wonderful. A great organization to donate to, for sure. If you're planning on stopping by to purchase baked goods, please remember to take your own takeout container or Tupperware. And then the second one happens on Sunday, May 2nd, this weekend as well, from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. This one happens at the Unitarian Church of Vancouver at 949 West 49th Avenue at Oak Street. Bring your bags and Tupperware and fill them up. Organic, fair trade, and gluten-free products available with the ingredients listed. They're all made by my friend Denise, who's an amazing baker. I can honestly say this, as I have on many occasions, had the luxury of sampling her delicious baked goods. They are out of this world. And this week alone, I sampled some brownies, an amazing orange nut type square with a creamy, delicious sweet frosting, and a tantalizing pecan square, also yummy. She's been baking up a storm these last few months to test recipes in preparation for this event, which is sure to be a success. Proceeds go to the Unitarian Church of Vancouver's Green Fund, which supports environmental initiatives. For more information on the Worldwide Vegan Bake Sale, go to veganbakesale.org. And if you have any upcoming events that you want to have announced on the show, you can post them on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver, or email us at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
Great. Thanks, Allison. So up next is Josh Harper. Josh is an animal rights activist who has participated in animal liberation, wilderness, and human freedom projects for more than 10 years. In 2004, he and his co-defendants, better known as Shaq 7, were indicted on terrorism charges. The crime Josh committed was that he made public speeches advocating for nonviolent direct action. After spending 3 years in federal prison, Josh is now out on probation and has graciously agreed to speak to us. Hello, Josh. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Hello. How are you?
Hi, Josh.
So you were...
Hello?
Hi. Can you hear us?
Sorry. Got a little bit of a blip on the phone there for a second.
So you were in prison for 3 years and labeled a terrorist for giving public speeches advocating for nonviolent direct action. After this experience, what are your thoughts about free speech and First Amendment rights in the U.S.?
Well, I suppose that my thought is that people tend not to fight for things that they believe they already have. Most Americans believe that they have a right to, within reason, say whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
After my experience, I'm not so certain that that's true. Certainly, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act creates a situation where you have viewpoint discrimination here in the United States, and where certain speech, if it's seen as advocating the abolition of a certain animal industry, or if it would tend to cause that business more than $10,000 worth of damage, that speech can now be labeled as terrorism. And unfortunately, thus far, all of our appellate courts have upheld that as being legal. So I'm not certain that animal rights activists in the United States have First Amendment rights.
That's crazy. Because to most people, the term terrorism conjures up images of the 9/11 attacks, and certainly that's what the government wants you to think. And, you know, terrorists are people we think commit violence and murder of innocent people on a grand scale. But with this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, you're saying that if they cause more than $10,000 of damage, they can become terrorists. So can you give us an example of who can be described as a terrorist under this law?
Certainly. Well, speaking from my own experience, I can say that because of the conspiracy clause in the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, you don't even actually have to cause damage. In our case, they argued that the conspiracy was that we wanted to shut down a certain British-based contract research organization. And by shutting it down, we would have caused more than $10,000 worth of damage. So we didn't go anywhere, and we didn't break anything, we didn't burn anything, we didn't bomb anything, we didn't hit anyone, but me and all of my co-defendants were convicted under a terrorism law for things that we wrote in newsletters, things that we posted on the Internet, or in my case, things that I said in public speeches. And the tactics that I was advocating wasn't beating anyone up, blowing something up, burning something down, but more mild forms of electronic civil disobedience, such as phone blockades, fax blockades, email blockades, things of that nature. And so for mere advocacy of those tactics, I am now a convicted terrorist.
Wow. So can you tell us specifically what was in your speech that you talked about?
One of the things that the government actually made a very large deal about, and that was the basis of the entirety of one of my charges, is called black faxing. And black faxing involves taking three sheets of black paper, and they get taped, so they go end to end to end. So now you have one long strip. It gets fed into a fax machine. A phone number gets dialed. In our case, the phone numbers generally were financial institutions with ties to this research organization. And once the black paper starts to feed through the fax machine, you tape the back end of the paper to the front end. So now you've got a continuous loop of black paper. So it's a form of electronic civil disobedience. I say it's civil disobedience because there's truly no way to hide where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
While you might be able to disguise your phone number from the company that it's going to, ultimately the phone companies, the telecommunications companies know where it's coming from. So so it's not an anonymous tactic. And what it does is it wastes toner and it wastes paper, but it more importantly ties up that line, which means that then you can't do business on it. So I mentioned this tactic at the end of one of the speeches that I made in front of a group of eight people, one of whom was an FBI agent.
Hmm.
And because of talking about that specific tactic, that tactic right there counted for 2 years out of my 3-year sentence.
Wow.
For speaking about that.
So you're a dangerous terrorist because you waste toner cartridge.
$10,000 worth.
How dare you? So why do you think throughout history peace activists are treated by governments with contempt and violence, while those committing the most unspeakable acts of violence, such as vivisectors and factory farmers and hunters, are fiercely defended by government?
Well, I have a number of theories on that, but I suppose one is that peace activists, animal rights activists, feminists, anti-racists, we're not a giant tax base, whereas vivisectors, biotechnology, pharmaceuticals, petrochemicals, agrochemicals, those are massive corporate interests that bring in millions of dollars every year into the tax base of both local governments, county governments, and federal governments. And then, of course, you also have the fact that basically, in the United States, politicians don't exactly protect their constituents so much as they protect their tax base and they protect lobbyists. In the United States, hunting has a tremendously large lobby. Pharmaceuticals are the number one lobby in the United States, with other forms of biotechnology and vivisection-related corporations not falling very far behind. So when you look at the financial interests out there, well, I think your average senator and congressperson is more concerned about a threat to a tax base than they are about my civil liberties.
Hmm. Now, can you tell us about the kind of prison you were in for 3 years? Was it a white-collar prison holding political prisoners, or were you in there with hardened criminals who have committed violent crimes?
It's strange because I've noticed on a lot of opposition websites that they say things that, like, the Shack 7 weren't punished harshly enough. And one of the things that I read was that I was in a white-collar minimum security prison, which isn't true. I was in a high-medium security prison. I don't want to make it sound like I was in the world's, like, toughest prison. I certainly wasn't. But it was still a place where violence and the threat of violence was pretty regular. Shortly prior to my being released to the halfway house, there was a fight there between three inmates where one inmate had a finger bitten off. There was definitely sexual violence happened there. I did see improvised weapons. There were guards at my prison who were convicted of bringing in heroin, marijuana, and tobacco to inmates. So I certainly wasn't in a pleasant environment.
Right. Now, there was an order from the judge to provide you with vegan food while you were in prison. Did that mean that prison staff assured that you were well-fed at every meal?
The judge had requested, while we were being held in a holding facility in New Jersey, that we receive vegan meals. The staff at that particular prison attempted to provide us with vegan meals, and sometimes they were successful, sometimes they weren't. However, this wasn't an actual court order. This was a court recommendation. And so when we arrived at our permanent places of residence in the Bureau of Prisons, we weren't provided with vegan meals. For 3 years, I basically ate spaghetti noodles. I ate oatmeal, peanut butter and crackers, and minute rice with rehydrated, defatted, refried beans. And that was pretty much my diet for 3 years. That wasn't provided to me by the prison. The way that I was able to eat those things was that caring people on the outside were putting money on my commissary account, and I was able to then buy those items through the prison store.
Oh,
and that's
my
how
God.
I ate.
Did you feel malnourished? You must have.
I definitely went through periods where I felt malnourished, but one thing you learn real quick in prison is how to, I guess the prison terminology would be to get over. And so I found guys who worked in the kitchen. I found guys who worked in the prison garden. There was a horticulture program there that inmates who are awaiting transfer to minimum securities could go into. And I basically found ways to pay those guys off to smuggle me vegetables. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that happened with a whole lot of frequency, but one situation that I specifically remember was a time that I managed to get a whole watermelon back to my cell for three books of stamps.
Wow. Now, vegan food in prison certainly sounds pretty shabby compared to the amazing food at your current workplace, Wayward mm-hmm. Cafe in Seattle. Everybody should go there.
I've been there.
Yeah, it's awesome. Now, did the lack of food choices limit your ability to spread veganism in prison?
You know, I'm sure that they did in some way, but I did convert a couple people to veganism.
No way!
Really? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. When I first got there, I was in a detention center, which was right next door to the main prison. And I had a cellmate at the time named Jesse, and he saw the struggle that I was going through to eat. I mean, at that point, I basically, like, was eating apples and beans, and that was it. And I think he kind of admired, though, that I was sticking with it. And he noticed all the magazines that I was getting in. People were sending me Veg News, and at that time, No Compromise, Bite Back, Sasha. And he just started asking to read these things. And then I would occasionally answer his questions when he would ask them. And then a little while later, after I got moved over to the main prison, guys were coming over and they'd find out that I was vegan and they'd say, oh, I met a vegan over next door. His name was Jesse.
No way. So
so he had apparently gone vegan. And then during the time that I was at Sheridan, I actually converted a few other people to vegetarianism and veganism, which is something that might actually shock the other inmates, because one guy in particular, when he went vegetarian, he was scared about the members of his gang finding out. He didn't want to appear like he was going soft. And so he was telling everyone that he was changing his diet for health reasons because he was trying to get more muscular and get more easily accessible, bioaccessible protein is what he told them. He never used the term vegetarian, but he was almost vegan. And so, yeah, I don't know, kind of a cool thing to be able to reach people even there.
Yeah, that's great. Now, when you were in prison, there was a dark period. A staff member found a couple of benign quotes from you in a magazine article, and based on those quotes, those in charge of you claimed that, quote, your celebrity-type status could influence others to commit terrorist acts. As a result, you were locked up in the hole for 97 days. Can you tell us what that experience was like?
Well, it was miserable. At that time, that was shortly after we had a staff member get caught bringing heroin in and bringing in tobacco. So there were raids that were happening throughout the prison, and so the hole was very overcrowded. There was a cell that was about 6 feet by 10 feet long that I was in 24 hours a day with two other inmates for more than 3 months.
Oh my God.
In the hole, I didn't have access to commissary, and so I was eating what little scraps were on the trays that were vegan, so pretty much apples and lettuce.
Oh, my God. For 3 months?
I'm sorry?
For 3 months you did that?
Yes, 3 months.
Wow.
And then, I don't know, I at one point had a cellmate in there who was pretty much the most frightening person that I'd ever met. And so one day when we were taken to the showers, I called out to the orderlies that the jumpsuit they'd given me was the wrong size. And when one of them came to the shower door, I bribed him to find me sharp objects. The orderlies could actually get to some of the same stations that the officers had access to. And so they brought me ink pens, and I actually had to sleep at night with ink pens in my hand in case I needed to stab this guy in the middle of the night. And keep in mind that I was put in this situation, this intense confinement, which is both physically and psychologically difficult. I was put in that situation, again, over speech and very mild speech at that.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there any point that you thought you might have given up veganism just to sustain yourself?
Absolutely not.
Wow. Here's for all the people who say, I can't give up cheese.
Yeah.
That frustrates me so much. I hear people all the time talking about how difficult it is to sustain a vegan diet. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand.
Right. You can do it in prison. It can be done.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's certainly more difficult. And I don't know what the situation in other prisons is like. But I personally, I made a promise to myself that that was something that was close to my heart. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to let the prison system take that from me, seeing right. how they were already taking so much.
Right.
So it was never a question. I never considered it once.
Wow. That's amazing. Now, after spending 3 years in federal prison, do you think you might have a better perspective on the suffering of the animals locked up at factory farms and in science labs?
Actually, one of the things that prison taught me is that I can't begin to comprehend what those animals are going through. Something that used to frustrate me when I was inside was that I would get letters from well-meaning people who would try to sympathize with my situation, and they would talk about, oh, I was arrested and I spent 2 days in jail once, or people would talk about, oh, I'm in college and I'm in this tiny little dorm room. I know exactly how you feel. No, you don't know how I feel. And so it kind of taught me that I was in a situation where, yes, it's true that I was in a cage for a while, and yes, it's true that there's that fear of violence, but at the end of the day, I knew that there was a time that I was going to get out, and I was going to see sunlight again, and my feet were going to touch grass again. Oh. I don't know what animals are going like who were born into slavery, who never see the blue sky, who spend their entire lives in a cage awaiting death. I don't know what they're going through, and I'm horrified to think about it. I guess in answer to your question, I feel like I sympathize more, but I still don't understand their situation entirely.
Wow, that really puts it into perspective, because what we heard from you sounds really horrible, and you're right. It's much, much more horrible what the animals are going through. Now, what has life been like since you've been out of prison?
it's strange because, initially you get out, and you're just so excited. You're just so happy to have options again. Mm-hmm. But one of the difficult things to explain to people on the outside is that prison is traumatizing. And you get out, and there's a tendency to see the support kind of drop off. People assume that since you're out, you must be happy and okay. I'm definitely still recovering from some of the things that happened to me in there. That being said, though, I go skateboarding, and I hang out with my friend's dog. Mm-hmm. I cook delicious food. I work at this great restaurant, and so life is certainly much, much better than it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there any projects you're currently working on that you'd like to tell us about?
Sure. I'm doing a podcast right now with my friend Rex Ray. Mm-hmm. It's called Vegan Threat. And that's going to, actually, the website, I believe, launches today at veganthreat.com.
And I'm writing that one down right now.
The first two episodes should be going up. They're a little rough, so I hope people stick with us. We're definitely still learning the whole podcast thing.
What's your podcast about?
It's sort of about whatever we want to talk about that week. Some weeks we do interviews. Other weeks are more news-oriented. Some weeks we talk about food. Some weeks we talk about activism. So, yeah, it's kind of eclectic, but I think that hopefully it'll be entertaining. And then eventually I'm also hoping to work on a book.
Great.
And, and then we have a local group that's getting started up that's going to be booking lecture tours. It's going to be very similar to the Let Live Foundation down in Portland.
That would be great.
That's going to be in Seattle?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The acronym is AREA. It's Animal Rights Education Alliance. And essentially we're trying to create more of a synergy between activists and local vegan businesses to where these vegan businesses can use their space to bring in animal rights lecturers and other educational events, movie showings and things like that. So it's mutually beneficial. Activists gain a space where they can hold these meetings and book these lectures. And then the businesses gain, hopefully, people who are interested in buying what they have to sell.
What's the animal rights movement like in Seattle?
The animal rights movement in Seattle is pretty diverse right now, I'd say. There's a number of different groups working on different projects. I guess the one disappointing thing about it is that there was a time where there were fewer vegans in Seattle, and I could pretty much say that this applies to the rest of the United States as well. There was a time where there were fewer of us, but we were more active, and I lay the blame squarely at Facebook for that. So basically, we have the situation now where people believe that by clicking a button, that they are creating change. They think that if they join a group, 1 million against horse slaughter or something
right.
like that,
right.
that it's going to create some kind of difference. But at the end of the day, if 1 million people or 2 million people or 3 million people join a group, I don't know what happens. I don't know what the actual consequence of that is. Whereas we used to sort of recognize that if you wanted change, you had to get out there and make it. Nowadays, I think vegans are maybe a little bit too comfortable. There was a time where I probably knew every vegan living in Portland where I first went vegan, because there's probably 20 of us. Mm-hmm. Well, now there's hundreds and hundreds, but they're getting lazy, and I want to see that change.
Right. Now, I'm one of those activists who's on Facebook a lot, and I see your photos you posted on Facebook, and you got a very interesting tattoo on your knuckles after you were released from prison. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. When I was in prison, there was a lot of guys who had very macho, tough guy knuckle tattoos that said, stay down, game over, things like that. When I got out, I got care a lot on my fingers, because I just felt that it kind of more accurately represented where I was coming from and what I was about.
Care
so,
a lot.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Great.
Oh, and for everyone out there who wants to make a Care Bears, I've heard it before. So.
That's great. I love it. You should have had that when you were in prison.
I'm glad that I didn't have it when I was in prison.
Oh, I can only imagine.
But I'm happy to have it now.
Great. Now, I know you have a lot of fans here in Vancouver. I know some people who don't normally listen to our show is listening today. Where might they bump into you if they go to visit Seattle?
Well, you know, first of all, I work at the Wayward Vegan Cafe.
Woo-hoo!
And I'm here 5 days a week. Everyone I work for and work with is wonderful. All the owners are vegan. All the employees are vegan. So you know that any money you spend here and anything that goes into that tip jar is in turn going to be spent on things that are vegan. Likewise, I spend a lot of time at other vegan-owned and operated businesses. So if you're in town and you happen to stop by, say, Pizza Pie or Sidecar for Pig Teeth, chances are fair that you'd bump into me.
So I was on that street just a couple of weekends ago. I don't know if you were at Seattle Veg Fest. I might have bumped into you there, too. But I went to Wayward Cafe in November, and now I wonder if you're the person that served me. Well, I'll find out next
possible.
Time. It's quite possible. We had a really good breakfast there. I was just talking about it this morning to my boyfriend. Oh, do you remember that place? Oh, was that the place where I had the blueberry pancakes? I couldn't believe he remembered that. So those pancakes must have really made a difference to him there. He remembers that.
We have a cook here named Ryan who used to cook at the Globe, if you were familiar with that sort of old Seattle vegan institution. And Ryan makes the best pancakes on earth. So if you come in on
the
day that
pancakes.
He's cooking...
Oh,
yeah, they're delicious.
You're going to have to send us Ryan's schedule so we'll go on the day he's cooking.
I'll try to do that.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Josh. Can you tell us about the websites that you have again?
Yeah, it's veganthreat.com. And the podcasts, I believe, are launching on that today. And thank you so much for having me.
Great.
Thank you, Josh.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Goodbye.
On next week's show, we will be featuring Claudia Lee from the local nonprofit organization Shark Truth on the show. Shark Truth is promoting awareness around the irreversibly detrimental effects of the shark finning industry. And right now, they are running a fantastic contest for newlywed couples that we'll be talking about as well. Also on next week's show, we'll be interviewing Josh Hooten of the Let Live Foundation to talk about the upcoming annual Let Live Animal Rights Conference in June in Portland, Oregon. You've been listening to the Animal Voices show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Please remember to sign up for our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. It's all one word. And please do send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. And we will talk to you next week.
Great. Have a good weekend.